Well, hey there. Welcome to Just to Be Nominated, a podcast about movies distributed by Lee Enterprises. The show is hosted by me, Chris Lay, the podcast operations manager for Lee, along with Bruce Miller, the editor of the Sioux City Journal, and Jared McNett, a reporter for the Globe Gazette in Mason City, Iowa. Last time you heard from us, we rounded up our top five literary adaptations. Books, short stories, even a graphic novel made an appearance. You can go back in the archives and definitely check that out if you would like to. This week, we fought some scheduling conflicts that may or may not have been organized by the Deep State to bring you some of our favorite conspiracy-centric films. So strap on your tinfoil helmet as Jared, Bruce, and I wade into the cinematic swamp to see just how deep the rabbit hole goes. You can check the show notes for links to where you can stream those movies that we talked about and discover our older episodes as well. The show kicks off after this short pause.
So what's the topic this week?
The topic this week is conspiracy theory or like conspiracy thriller type movies. And the reason why we went with conspiracy theories or conspiracy thrillers was because at the time, and it hasn't stopped at all, is the whole QAnon, quagmire, I suppose, is still very much alive and well in American political discourse for absolutely absurd reasons.
And if you're looking for like even more of a like a movie connection at this point, is bled into like Hollywood and stuff, even with like the people they're just convinced are either like, you know, the masterminds of like child, like slave cabals or have been replaced by clones. You get a whole dose of that mixed in with Hollywood, which obviously is always going to be one of the things that people go for when they craft conspiracy theories.
Who's going first?
I can go first because the first one I had on my list actually kind of fits with some of the 9/11 conspiracy theory stuff. And that's from 1990, Jacob's Ladder was my first pick. And the reason I say that it's kind of a similar thing to the 9/11 conspiracy theories is I think if you look at that movie, which is fantastic, one of my favorite movies from the 90s, and it's one of my favorite like Vietnam movies and one of my favorite just war movies, period, is that kind of like with the 9/11 conspiracy theories, some of the like, you know, conspiratorial thinking that goes along in that movie is clearly kind of happening to sort of like paper over like losses and inadequacies and just fault lines like in like the structure of the country, which that's the reason a lot of conspiracy theories happen, right? Is like you don't want to accept whatever the actual reality is of like your situation or like the situation of like your city or your state or your country. And so instead of like dealing in that reality, you have to craft all these other fantastical kinds of things, which Jacob's Ladder is obviously very much about. And as it goes along, you're not even really clear if any of this like actually happened or if this is just, you know, the way that this particular guy is dealing with his trauma from serving in Vietnam. I love it. And it's one of my favorites.
Does it hold up? Have you watched it recently?
I've watched it fairly recently. And yeah, I think it holds up pretty well. There's a little bit of just extremely 90s kind of stuff because that director whose name is escaping my mind was just a very 90s director because he also did Fatal Attraction, I think was also him. So yeah, there's it's very much 90s in that way, but story-wise I think it still holds up pretty well.
The director is Adrian Lin, who, I mean, you mentioned Fatal Attraction, but he did 9.5 Weeks, he did Indecent Proposal, he did the late 90s remake of Lolita, or I guess maybe not remake, adaptation. And yeah, it's interesting to see, you know, someone who's, you know, so much of their career is defined by these sexy thriller, you know, type things. And then, I mean, the one that you mentioned, Jacob's Ladder, is definitely still one of his more popular ones. It just feels like a real outlier because it's just this psychologically deep hole that you wander in down Tim Robbins' character.
You know, Tim Robbins is kind of conspiracy theory actor. A lot of things he does has that kind of, you know, what?
Yeah.
Taint to it. And he's a good guy because you can't really tell if he's all there or if he's, you know what I mean? He has that ability to be very enigmatic. Maybe that's the term. Yeah. But you never really get a handle on who he is during a lot of things until there's a twist and then it comes out and you go, oh my God, yeah, he's the bad guy.
Because even in like something like the War of the Worlds version that he was in, which is not a good movie, but his character in that ends up being like really kind of frightening.
He was the bad guy in Howard the Duck as well, wasn't he?
I think everybody was the bad guy in Howard the Duck.
Oh man, that movie, woof.
It starts with a costume. You know, when you see that duck costume, you think, who in the hell thought this was going to work?
Yeah.
And then it goes from there.
So, how about you, Bruce? What you got?
You ready for the man? Well, you know, I have a weird, I'm going to go way back. The Manchurian Candidate, because it kind of started all this stuff where you worry about, well, is this true? What's going on here? And when you've got somebody like Angela Lansbury, who I just love in everything she does, playing this kind of wicked mom, I can't keep my eyes off it. And it's one that shows up all the time on TCM or some of those kind of channels. But it was one of those things where you think, oh, maybe there could be something behind this. Maybe somebody is pulling the strings. And now when we see the way things are in politics these days, it isn't that far-fetched.
It's weird to me that came out before the Kennedy assassination, because you would think it was a later in the 60s movie than it actually was, based on like the themes and everything, how it plays out.
And it had a problem being released because of that. You know, they said, well, wait a minute, we can't have this out here because what is this going to be? What is this going to do? And yeah, and it really found its audience much later than that.
Do you think that's one that benefited by the fact that the conspiracy type stuff followed the, you know, real life Kennedy assassination and the, you know, Ciaran, Bobby Kennedy assassination, and then all of the Nixon conspiracy stuff?
I think we were in a period where we accepted anything. And here was a movie that said, you, wait a minute, everything isn't as it's presented. There's something else there. And I think we start looking for conspiracy theories in a lot of things.
And then literally even the title is something we just use as like a phrase now as a descriptor.
Completely.
Right.
Of like, this person could be like a Manchurian candidate.
You could, you know, now the Russian candidate, the Chinese candidate, the whatever candidate, you could use it easily in a campaign.
Well, I mentioned like Ciaran. Isn't that his whole thing? Is like his whole defense is that he was, you know, his mind was warped by like the CIA to, you know, be triggered by something or other to then, you know, kill somebody.
He's consistently maintained like over the years that he has no recollection whatsoever of like the actual assassination. Yeah, there's been fun conspiracy theories about him in particular because he was a jockey for a while when he was younger. And he got in like a horrible like racing accident and suffered a head injury from that. And there's been some fun little conspiracy theories about that the hospital he got treated at was also doing like MK Ultra experiments at the time. And so that might be your explanation for what he ended up doing later.
Yeah. And it's also worth throwing out there that Frank Sinatra, it's crazy how he could have been as talented at acting as he was. And, you know, just kind of, it was just like a side gig for him, just a hobby. Between that, Guys and Dolls, The Man with the Golden Arm, all those, you know, where he did great.
From Here to Eternity, where he won the Oscar. Yeah, he was a good actor. I think, though, he really didn't know how to turn one spigot off and turn the other one on. So he kind of dabbled. There were a number of ones like that. You know, Fred Astaire had another kind of world going with serious acting and not just doing musicals, and that was a little different for him. So it's, yeah, you know, we see it. Beyonce, what's she doing? Is she going to act anymore or just do kind of odd specials for HBO?
Yeah, it's hard to tell.
Okay, Chris, it's your turn.
Yep. So Jared actually reached out to me the other day and asked if a documentary would be okay. And I said, use your own discretion. I don't know if it fits the, you know, the theme of the topic, you know, to a T, but we'll, you know, I trust you to make good decisions. And then I knee-jerk just ended up putting on a film on Netflix last night called Wormwood.
Wormwood? I don't know that.
Wormwood, it was from 2017. It's a six-part series directed by Errol Morris. It's half documentary and it's half film, like biopic. And it tells the story of Frank Olson, who was a scientist who worked, at Fort Detrick, Maryland, working on the MK Ultra project, which Jared mentioned just a second ago. And he jumped out of a window, a 10-story window in New York, to his death. And it's all about his family trying to find out what the details were of this whole situation, because the government didn't, you know, go into a whole lot of depth on what it was. He apparently was dosed unknowingly, and then his life kind of unraveled over the span of a few days leading up to him jumping out of the window. And so there's these intense, long interviews that Errol Morris does, which he's famous for, with Frank Olson's son, about the entire, you know, digging in and trying to find out what it was. MK Ultra, for anybody who's unaware, was it was a CIA trying to use LSD as a means of truth serum or some kind of, I mean, anything to break down, you know, enemy combatants' you know, ability to withhold secrets or mental stability in some way or other. And it got shut down at some point because it's obviously a completely insane thing to even, you know, be dabbling in. Errol Morris kind of pioneered the process of filming, like, the interviews for the documentary, and then also staging these reenactments, going back to The Thin Blue Line, which is probably the best example of that in his, you know, film work. But the versions of, like, the biopic stuff in here, starts Peter Sarsgaard as Frank Olson, Tim Blake Nelson in there, and yeah, it's just a really gripping, you know, 6-part miniseries on Netflix that is worth jumping into. And yeah, I feel like it's maybe cheating that I went in on a documentary, but I feel like it's as a biopic, it fits enough for me to throw it in the mix.
Well, and it's such a specific kind of thing too, which I think a lot of these work so much better when it's a singular event as opposed to trying to, like, encompass something more about the, you know, conspiracy theories or whatever else.
He has one coming up about Timothy Leary, and I talked with him this last week about that. It's interesting how he kind of likes these very similar themes, and it'll be fascinating to see what that turns out to be. I didn't get to see any of it, but it'll be interesting.
He's such an interesting filmmaker, Errol Morris. I know, I mean, I haven't seen it yet, but I really want to see the film that he recently put out, where it's him interviewing Steve Bannon, kind of along the same lines of the series of films that he has done interviewing these very contentious political figures, where he did Robert McNamara for The Fog of War, talking about Vietnam, and he did, what is it, Unknown Knowns?
Unknown Known.
Yeah, The Unknown Known was a very long series of interviews that he did with Donald Rumsfeld, and it seems like this film with Steve Bannon seems very much in that lineage. How revealing it'll be, no one knows.
You mentioned Steve Bannon. This last weekend, I watched Spaceship Earth. Have you seen that documentary about Biosphere 2?
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one they put in to take over when they think that everything is kind of corrupt. And they say, let's get Steve Bannon in here to figure things out for us. And I thought, wow, that guy's been around a long time.
Well, my next one, this is a good pivot because this is also very specific, and it's also a documentary, is what I reached out to Chris about, and I only watched it this week for the first time and absolutely loved it and had somehow entirely forgotten about the event that the movie is about, and that's 2019's Tread, which is about a welder in Colorado. In, like, small town Colorado, who has, like, a series of disputes with the town council and with the local, like, drainage district officials and everything. And eventually all of that boils over into him buying a bulldozer, and then for 18 months in, like, a little rat hole, basically, him armoring it while he watches a man apart with Vin Diesel. And then he takes that killdozer out and he destroys half of the town, and he shoots it up with a 50 caliber rifle, and then eventually he kills himself. And the reason I was spoiler on that, I guess, but it happened in the actual events happened in 2004, I think. But the reason they've kind of been memory hold a little bit because that's such a like just unbelievably unusual and nightmarish kind of thing is that like literally the next day after that rampage is when Ronald Reagan died. So it's kind of been forgotten about completely until this movie. And I didn't even remember it, even though I'm always up on kind of very off the beaten path stuff like this. But the reason I picked it is because it's a good example of, you know, a lot of these conspiracy theories are very big and like are conceptualized as being, you know, like entire countries or like entire agencies of the government or whatever else. But in this case, it's all very localized. This guy has all of these like conspiratorial thoughts about like everyone else in the town that they're out to get him and everything like this. And it's like, no, this is just the way that, you know, like local government bodies are pretty inept or can be pretty inept. That, you know, the people aren't like careerist politicians. They're, just, you know, people who live in the town and want to be on these boards. And so I thought it just worked really well as sort of a depiction of that, of how there's no level too small for like conspiratorial thinking to kind of creep into. And really the only reason, even though this is such a nightmarish thing, the only reason there's not more examples of this maybe is that this guy just had more commitment, I guess, and had more like access to resources to make his like kind of like fantasy a reality.
I have never heard of it.
Oh, it came out on Netflix just a couple of weeks ago, I think. Maybe like three, yeah. I mean, less than a month, I want to say, is when it hit Netflix. And yeah, I will agree. I mean, that was a intense spoiler description of everything that happens in there. But it's interesting because, I mean, the way that they present the town early on and the way that some of the people that are in the documentary, you know, talk about the town, still validates his view that the town was against him. There was a conspiracy to, you know, to bump him out because he wasn't originally from there, that he was this kind of new money person. I mean, as much as of like, you know, new money you can be when you own a, you know, muffler shop.
So. Well, and it's interesting too, because like, it's like one of those cases of like, you know, plenty of times people will like just kind of casually say like, I, you know, they'd like, they have their own little like revenge fantasies or power trips or whatever, but it's like, yeah, this is what would actually happen if you realized that. It would not be cool or like righteous or like any kind of like triumphant thing. It would be horrifying and like bizarre.
I mean, ultimately it ends up being kind of pathetic in a way.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, all that he ended up doing was just destroying, I don't know how many, you know, multiple millions of dollars of property damage. But
yeah,
I mean, it seems like, I mean, everyone just kind of was just like, yeah, this guy just kind of, you know, screwed up our town for a few months afterwards, I guess, because he was, you know, crazy and spent too much time in his hot tub on his porch. Yeah, it's a fascinating documentary, one that's maybe not so good for quarantining, because so much of it is about him holding up in his garage to work on fortifying this bulldozer.
Wow. Well, I feel really kind of lame coming in with my number two, which is JFK from Oliver Stone.
Ah, you got to have that on here.
Absolutely.
Am I just kind of filling a niche? Maybe that's what it is.
No. I mean, it really is kind of the granddaddy of all conspiracy.
But, you know, with Oliver Stone, he always threw out wild ideas. And you go,
yeah,
I'm not so sure. But then you watch it and you go, you know, maybe there's some truth to that. You know, he doesn't have that profile anymore. But at the time, he was very Oracle-like. And people would go, you know, maybe this guy is on to something. And I think it gave Kevin Costner one of his better performances, too.
I mean, the rest of that cast is entirely stacked as well.
Yeah.
It's better than it should be.
It's so long, though. I will say it is. I mean, it's interesting to hear you throw this on there, Bruce, because I know you despise long movies.
I hate long movies. You know that.
Yeah, but this is, I mean, this comes in at just over 3 hours. And I mean, would you say that it's too long, or would you say that it's...
Oh, they're all too long. Even my favorite films are too long. I love Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I could cut out crap out of that too. But yeah, too long. It's always too long. But you know, he has to make his case, and then he's one of those directors that always thinks there's something behind something.
Yeah.
And sometimes there isn't. There's nothing. but I like the idea that he thinks that way.
Yeah. I mean, the point that you bring up with him, you know, seeing things, you know, like the man behind the man kind of stuff is very accurate. And JFK is certainly the pinnacle of that in his career.
Right. It's not his best movie.
No.
But of those kind of conspiracy theory things, it's his best shot at it.
Yeah.
Do you think that we would still be dealing with like JFK conspiracy theory stuff in the same way if that movie had never happened? Or do you think it would have kind of like withered more by now?
No, I think there'd still be conspiracy theory ones about him. Because are you really sure? Do you really know
right.
what happened? And they're even mentioning people in politics today that they say had something to do with. And you think, well, that's how many years ago?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that really legit?
Yeah.
I mean, didn't Trump, like, just, you know, a few years ago accuse Ted Cruz's dad? Well, he accused his dad of being the Zodiac killer. But I think he also said that, like, his...
They said Ted Cruz looked like the Zodiac killer, but that, yeah, his dad was involved in the JFK assassination. Or hinted at it, I guess I should say.
Wow. Okay, Chris, let's hear something else I haven't seen.
Well, I mean, this one might be something that you've seen. I'm going to go back a little bit. I mean, just to 1980. But there's a movie called Hopscotch, which it's directed by Ronald Moon, who directed probably most notably The Poseidon Adventure. But Hopscotch is a movie about a CIA guy, like an older CIA operative played by Walter Matthau, who basically is kind of pushed out in favor of younger CIA agents taking his place. And he just kind of disappears and shreds his file and goes out and he's like, I'm going to write my memoirs. And so he starts, you know, mailing these, you know, chapters of the memoirs detailing all the you know, horrendous things that the CIA has done that he was a part of to various places, and the CIA just wants to track him down. It's a kind of fun little, you know, cat and mouse game of the CIA trying to, you know, chase him down. It's got a great cast with Sam Waterston as the younger agent who's kind of taken his place, and Ned Beatty as the hotshot new CIA head who is the one who pushes him out. And yeah, it's Walter Matthau is just an absolute treasure in this film. And rewatching it this time, I thought of it as greatest generation porn. Because, I mean, like, Walter Matthau is, you know, a member of the greatest generation. It's him in his, you know, later years. Definitely, you know, retirement age for greatest generation type people. And it's him, you know, methodically and competently and systematically just dismantling every attempt to track him down. And he's always, you know, a few steps ahead. And the comedy is really great. And Walter Matthau apparently ad-libbed a whole bunch of his lines. And yeah, it's just really great. And oh, and yeah, the main thing that I took away from it is Walter Matthau drinking foamy beers. Every single time that he pours a beer in this movie, it foams up crazily. And then he is, you know, just like trying to sip beer through this foam. It's ridiculous. So yeah, very, very funny movie about CIA black ops shenanigans.
That kind of leads some credence to the notion, you know, that with those kind of guys, the people you or those kind of agencies or even organizations or whatever, the people that are always going to be the best to talk to are never the people at the top. It's always some guy like Walter Matthau's character in Hopscotch. Just like a mid-level kind of just, you know, 9-to-5 type.
Yeah. I worked for a couple of years in elementary school as a teaching assistant. I don't know, like probably what, 15 years ago, maybe. And one of my takeaways from working there, even in a low level, was the power in those kind of bureaucracies is never with the people who are at the top. Like the two individuals who made things happen at that school, and I'd imagine just about every single, you know, school in America, was the office, like the head office secretary and the head custodian.
Yep.
Those were the two people who, if you were friends with those two people, you were in. Like, you got whatever. I mean, like, they were just, they knew all the dirt. They knew where the bodies were hidden, you know, and yep. They were the people to have the
I mean, like, they're not, you know, climbing any rungs. They're not, you know, trying to, you know, move up in any professional ladders. They're where they're at, and they're just good at what they do, and they, you know, see every single aspect of what's going on.
Information is currency in those cases. Even Ferris Bueller's Day Off, the secretary knew a lot about what was going on.
Oh, yeah, and absolutely.
It's kind of fascinating. The producers of Hopscotch, I just looked this up, the Landaus, they produced something that was really bizarre back in the 70s, and that was a subscription series of films that you had to buy all of the tickets in advance, and then you went to the theater or the movie theater, and you saw these films. It was big, big names. You know, Katharine Hepburn, Laurence Olivier, big names.
Huh.
In a lot adaptations of plays. It's a lot like what people are saying now we probably should do with movies. And so you'd go there, and they'd even give you a program. It was like a playbill for a Broadway show. And it had this kind of very kind of music at the beginning to make you settle down. And it was all designed to be at a higher level or a higher tone of movie making. And the only movie that really kind of hit somewhere was The Man in the Glass Booth. It got an Oscar nomination for Maximilian Schell. But those kinds of things, they were trying something different way back then that could have worked today when we're wondering, how are we going to open theaters and what are we going to do? Well, they sold tickets in advance. You had to have a subscription or else you couldn't see any of them. And after they were gone, they didn't show up anywhere. So that's from the Hopscotch people.
And I think you've actually mentioned that in the past. I can't remember
what our topic was. And these are the people behind it. And you think, really? They did this and they did that?
Yeah.
So I think they were just looking for something different. And maybe that's the key to this. Let's go on to the next one.
All I have to say at first for my next one is 3 more days till Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. 3 more days till Halloween, Silver Shamrock. My next pick is Halloween 3 from 1982, which is sneakily my favorite Halloween movie, other than, of course, the original. I wanted to pick this one because there are two kind of different tracks of conspiracy theories in this movie. There's in Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, there's a like corporate conspiracy track, which, you know, even now we love those. I mean, this year we had the whole Wayfair thing, what, not even a month ago, where people were convinced that kids were being shipped in furniture crates by the Wayfair company. So this has some of that in there of these, like, you know, it's not, corporations aren't bad enough on their own. We have to attribute all this extra stuff to them. But in this case, the conspiracy theories end up being true. But then the other track of why I wanted to pick this is sort of, it's also a great movie about like kinder conspiracies. You know, from a very early age, in some form or fashion, we all get taught different types of conspiracy theories. It's just that some might be like less harmful than others. And I'm sure we all have versions of, you know, like don't go to that house on Halloween or this house. And, you know, there's razor blades and like the Tootsie Rolls or whatever, or, you know, someone in a neighborhood is like spiking the Starburst with like LSD and all this kind of thing. And so this movie also definitely has some of that too, of these like pint-sized kid versions of conspiracy theories that we really are kind of inundated with from like a very early age on.
So did it scare you when you first saw it?
I only actually finally got around to seeing that one a couple years ago, because for the longest time it had a reputation of just being a really bad and terrible movie, even for like the Halloween franchise. But because it has nothing to do with Michael Myers or any of the other movies, it was kind of a standalone. And originally that was the plan, is that the Halloween movies after Halloween 2 were each going to be about something different. But the original response to Halloween 3 was so bad that they kind of scrapped that, and then they brought Michael Myers back for the fourth one. So for a long time, all of that initial reception kind of kept me away from it. But when I finally watched it, I loved it. It's a lot of fun. It's got some good scares in it. The masks in it are very, very creepy. And it just works very well, like I said, as like a kid version of like conspiracy theory stuff.
Yeah, and that's one that is definitely, I think, when it came out, was immediately despised by a lot of people, mainly because of the hard left turn. Like, you can do you know, one movie and then the next one can in that, you know, anthology series, whatever, can kind of be along those lines, you know, and change course. But to have two films establishing it is, it's too much momentum to all of a sudden say, oh, we're going to change it up. And, oh, you liked Michael Myers and you thought he was a great, you know, antagonist. Well, we're not going to put him in this one at all.
There's a movie about Celtic cults.
It's so wild. But it has definitely made a pretty strong comeback, I think, amongst a bunch of people. Just because, I mean, you have to watch it outside of the context of Halloween.
Yeah.
Jared, you're the horror meister here.
Yes.
Where does it sit with all of the other horror films that you like?
In that case, it goes down a little bit because, I mean, there's a lot that I really love. But in terms of, like, fun, it's way up there for me in terms of just objectively fun horror movies. It would be near the top of that list, at least.
Hmm.
Would kids find it terrifying?
Probably so. And it's definitely not a kid-friendly movie, even though it definitely deals with, like, kid conspiracy theories. Because there's still some, like, pretty gnarly, like, gore stuff in there, but it's a good teenage movie for sure, because if you're a teenager, you're just like ripping on everything anyway. So
are they moral? Do they end up killing kids that are in bed together?
Not in this case. It really kind of everyone in this movie gets it, so yeah, there's no same kind of moral judgments being passed in this one with the killers.
You know, going back to the last one that Chris had, you can always tell who the killer is by looking at the billing. And the billing, if the third billed person is of some note, that's your killer.
Yep.
Another good rule of thumb to go by is the rule of thumb from the office that Dwight shares, which is it's not the person you most suspect, and it's not the person you least suspect. It's the person you most medium suspect. Which I think there's truth to.
So that clears Dwight, right?
Yes.
Okay, you ready for my number three?
Let's hear it.
Yes.
Coming in at number three, I sound like all I do is watch mainstream pictures. So I'm going to have, next time we do a list, I'm going so off the wall, you're going to be shocked. But my number three is Wag the Dog. I think this is what we hear all the time in politics is diversion. They want to change the narrative. They don't want to talk about things that maybe we should be talking about. And so this film talked about how they do that diversion tactic at a time when we probably weren't thinking about it because there were a lot of scandals going on. But, you know, here the president is in trouble with a sex scandal. Okay. Around that time, we were dealing with a president with a sex scandal. And so how did they change the narrative? They went with a war. And was there a need for a war? No, but it was a good way of getting people off track.
Yeah.
And, you know, is that what we're seeing today in real life? I don't know. But there are things that I wish that they would concentrate on. And here we get two biggies, Robert De Niro and Dustin Hoffman in a film. That's pretty good. Anne Heche was never better than this.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's a fun little film to revisit from now and again, because you find out things that, yeah, I can apply that to today. So I think it was far more forward thinking than I thought it would be at the time.
I think that was like right around the time of, the Kosovo situation, if I remember correctly, where
Wag the Dog was released 1 month before the outbreak of the Lewinsky scandal and the subsequent bombing of a pharmaceutical factory in Sudan by the Clinton administration in August 1998.
Yeah.
And then, it was made again. The comparisons to Wag the Dog were made again in spring of 99 when the Clinton administration intervened in Kosovo.
So you see, we've never been without these kinds of things. This is part of our fabric. They just called him on it with the movie.
That kind of thing even exists now of people thinking that, like even pretty serious, like political people, not quacks by any means. I heard speculate before this year started or even a year or two ago, they were just convinced, oh, like, you know, when it gets closer to election time, Donald Trump is just going to start a war somewhere, which, you know, 2 months before the election, that hasn't happened. But like, it's interesting how something like that from a movie couldn't just like spread like that and like, yeah, become much like the Manchurian candidate, be this thing that is just like pretty mainstream in like political coverage.
And you can see it on a state level as well, where a candidate will be kind of guilty of something, and then they start talking about a whole new issue. And you say, well, wait a minute now. We haven't finished with that last issue. Let's go back and talk about that. And it's just changing the narrative is all it is. But Wag the Dog, my number three.
Nice. My next one is a little off the beaten path, I suppose.
No, I'm not seeing any of these films.
Well, you might have. You might have seen this one. It's from 1985.
Okay.
It stars Tom Hanks.
Oh, man.
So 1985, Tom Hanks.
Turner and Hooch?
No. It is The Man with One Red Shoe.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So you have seen
Can
that.
I tell you what? Now, this tells you how old I am. When that came out, they sent you one red shoe in the mail.
Oh, my gosh.
So I got one red shoe. That's as much as I remember about the film.
Wait, do you still have that swag somewhere?
No, I don't have it.
Oh, man, that would have been fantastic.
Sometimes you got to call the herd.
Chris, I always love your picks because they always feel like the movie that would have been the third preview on a VHS for another movie. And I love that. That's the aesthetic that they have.
The more, like, I don't know if it's just like the older I get or what, but I find so much comfort in these like mid-budget. Like they're not big budget, but it's not a small thing.
No,
it's still a studio picture, but it's you know, aimed at an adult audience. It's not, you know, offensive. It's not like a hard R. And this is definitely in that category. It's Tom Hanks, you know, right around, you know, the peak of, you know, the first wave of his, you know, ability to, you know, be a draw. And yeah, he is a violinist. And he's getting off a plane and he only has one shoe on and he's picked out at random by someone as, you know, who, you know, pins this conspiracy thing on him. It's like he's a spy. And then so all of these CIA agents start to infiltrate his life in very screwball comedy ways. The actual cast is really deep and really great. It's Tom Hanks, obviously. The two, I don't know how many movies they did together, but Dabney Coleman and Charles Durning are two examples of, like, if those guys are in a movie, either of them, I'm like, well, I'm on board. I feel like Tootsie is one of the other movies that they're both in. And that also fits the, you know, mid-budget adult film that they just don't really make a whole lot anymore.
Aren't those the things they put on Netflix?
Kind of, but I feel like the things on Netflix are all kind of goofy. I don't know. The only thing that I can think of is the way that Netflix has been doing like romantic comedies. And this is certainly not that. And I guess, what was it? Palm Springs is maybe the closest that we could get to that. But that wasn't originally supposed to be a streaming thing on Hulu. That was, you know, bought with the intention of being, you know, in theaters, which would have been, I think, a much better way to see that, that particular film.
So how was Tom Hanks? Was he good?
Yeah, Tom Hanks is really good. I mean, it's a little broad, it's a little goofy. Yeah, but Tom Hanks is really good in it. He's in it, and his best buddy is played by Jim Belushi in a very Jim Belushi role. Jim Belushi's wife is played by Carrie Fisher, and Carrie Fisher is having a thing with Tom Hanks. So they've got this little, you know, secret kind of love triangle going on. And then there's also one of the CIA operatives is trying to woo him to get, you know, better access to figure out what kind of a spy he is and who he's representing and whatever else. And of course he has nothing at all, you know, as far as like spy aspirations, but he keeps getting caught in these situations where he seems very spy-like in the way that he handles something or the way that, you know, something he's saying to Jim Belushi or Carrie Fisher can be, you know, interpreted as code. And it just drives the people that are trying to track him down crazy and sort of, you know, shows that in a way it's a little bit like, any one of us, if we were observed from the right angle, could be seen as, you know, a counter insurgency, whatever, you know, force, I suppose.
That's another second movie we've had that in a row that has Jim Belushi in it. So
he's the conspiracy actor.
There you go.
He's the one that ties it all together.
Okay, Jared, what's next?
So my next one is one I've mentioned in conversation before, but I haven't picked for anything. And that is Secret Honor, the Robert Altman movie, which I'm quite fond of and love quite a bit. And the reason I wanted to pick this one is because usually with a lot of conspiracy theories, they don't start at the top of the food chain. They start kind of at the bottom. Historically, that's the way conspiracy theories function, you know, is that like it's a way for us to explain what those like greedy bastards up above us are doing in one way or another. But one of the fascinating things of Secret Honor, which is a movie with Philip Baker Hall and no one else, where he plays a later in life Richard Nixon, who is just drunkenly pacing around his house in Jersey, which I think everyone in Jersey does, with a loaded revolver and like some whiskey and a tape recorder, where he's just monologuing and he's talking about his time in office, his time before office, and all these different things. And it's so fascinating because there are points in the movie, especially near the end, where he starts explaining away all of his faults as a president, as being the will actually of the Bohemian Grove, which is this thing in California that's long been the subject of a lot of different conspiracy theories. It's how Alex Jones first got famous. He like broke into Bohemian Grove and documented what was going on, which was basically just a bunch of rich guys hanging out in like hot tubs and stuff. But I just find it very fascinating and worthwhile to pick this one because it's one of the few instances I can think of like these conspiracy theories being pieced together by someone at the top versus the way these usually turn out.
The interesting thing about playing real people, how well does he do?
It's by far my favorite Richard Nixon that I've seen in a movie. I think that like the Franklin Jello one in Frost Nixon is good, but he's not paranoid enough in that movie as Richard Nixon apparently was like in real life and all the like documentation we have of that. And also like Richard Nixon was just kind of a weird guy, and Philip Baker Hall definitely gets that part of it right too. So he 10 out of 10 for me in terms of him playing Richard Nixon.
Yeah. Worth seeking out if anybody is enjoying this line of conversation or the weird political, you know, things. And that's on the Criterion Channel, which along with Hopscotch is also on the Criterion Channel. If anybody needs an added bonus reason to dive in on that.
Coming up on Showtime is a two-parter called The Comey Rule about James Comey and Donald Trump. And it's interesting how Brendan Gleeson plays Donald Trump. It's an interesting performance. And I talked with Jeff Daniels, who plays James Comey, and he said he would jump at the chance to play Donald Trump in a movie. And I said, why? He said, because there's so much there. But he said, the thing you have to worry about is, are people going to come after you for the way you portrayed him? But he said, he's a classic character that you would love to do as an actor, but there's so much kind of surrounding him at this point, it would be very difficult to do him now.
Well, have I told you guys who I genuinely, like the only person I ever would want to be interested in seeing do a Trump movie would be?
I don't think so.
By far, the only one I'd ever be interested in doing it, because I think he could do it, even though he looks nothing like him, but I think he could get down all of the mentality and everything else, is Nick Cage.
Huh.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think he would crush that.
Well, we might see it too. There's an opportunity.
I just watched Color Out of Space.
Mm-hmm. Amazing movie.
And I think that movie makes a surprisingly cogent argument for Nick Cage as Trump in a way. I mean, just in the way that he can play, you know, very, very low and also very deranged.
Yes.
He's going to be tied up doing Tiger King for the next however long for Amazon. So,
okay, Tiger King, let's put that one out there. Could that be considered a conspiracy film?
I mean, it's a conspiracy against Carol Baskin, maybe.
Yes.
Poor Carol Baskin. She killed her husband and put him underneath the tank or whatever it was.
Yep.
It's a conspiracy to music lovers everywhere who were fooled into believing that that Tiger King was actually the person singing those songs. Maybe.
I know it. I don't like hearing that. I like to think he was that, but there
sorry,
you are.
Bruce.
There, you ruined it for me.
Sorry.
Okay, my next one. Are you ready for me?
Holler.
Yes.
My number four is maybe an obvious one, but The Conversation, Francis Ford Coppola's second film out of, was it 1974? He had Godfather Part II and Conversation. And Conversation was seen as a throwaway because everybody was putting their money on the sequel to The Godfather. And that is one of my favorite movies, The Godfather Part II. But this is a really, really good film. Gene Hackman stars as a man who listens in, hears a conversation, thinks there's something going on there, starts acting on it. And it's a great performance of his. So colored, so detailed, so many things there. And then there are other characters in there that you think, wow. And one of them was Cindy Williams from Laverne and Shirley, who had a great little acting career going in films. Mm-hmm. She was in American Graffiti, this, and then she switched to TV, and I don't think she ever kind of looked back. But she had a good movie career going there for a while. And it was, I think it did really well in other places. Did it win? Let me look.
It won the Palme.
So see, there, people are looking at it and think, wow, look at this. So how can one director do two really great things like that? Well, they're very different. Godfather Part II is really glossy and kind of big Hollywood kind of film. And this is like an indie film. And maybe it was his shot at trying to do those kinds of things.
It's sweaty, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a movie that's in, like, I know that when, you know, all those like movie brat guys, you know, talk about the movies they wanted to make, it was, you know, these small personal pictures, and they all ended up going off and doing, you know, these crazy other things. And I feel like The Conversation is that the small personal picture that, you know, Coppola made, you know, in between, you know, two of the greatest American films ever. And, you know, The Conversation really holds up as one of the greatest films of his career, much less also in The Conversation for, you know, one of the greatest films ever made. Gene Hackman is absolutely incredible in that.
Well, it's wild, too, that like Bruce, with your last pick, Wag the Dog, both of these movies, like, literally pre-staged stuff that happened not shortly after, because, like, The Conversation came out just a couple of months before Nixon resigned as president. And, I mean, this is extremely a Watergate movie, even though it, like, you know, came out right before the scandal fully, like, developed into Nixon having to resign, which is pretty amazing to think about considering the themes of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think we're going to see that now? Are we going to see films like that that are kind of forward-thinking, or are we just looking back?
It's tougher to be forward-thinking now, just considering the speed that everything moves at, I think. What's true or what might be true now, it might be completely, like, unremarkable, or nobody will even care 5 minutes from now, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Chris, what's yours?
So, yeah, the next one for me is a little movie called They Live.
Yes.
John Carpenter's absolutely ridiculous film of, I mean, it's, yeah, stars Rowdy Roddy Piper and Keith David. Rowdy Roddy Piper is a semi-homeless or, you know, transient construction worker who stumbles upon a pair of glasses that when he puts them on, he can see the world as it really is, including all of these, you know, subliminal messages that have been incorporated into advertising and, I mean, every facet of American life, all to, you know, forward the cause and bolster these kind of alien creatures that are keeping America and presumably the world just very passive. We're very, right, very pacified. And there is, I mean, the film's probably best known for an 18 or 20 minute fight scene between Rowdy Roddy Piper and Keith David. The reasoning behind the fight is Rowdy Roddy Piper wants Keith David to put on the glasses, and Keith David doesn't want to put on the glasses. And so they absolutely have a brawl for a very long time.
I think it's the best fight in any movie ever.
Yeah.
Like, it's incredible. We were talking about the conversation being sweaty. That fight is sweaty and just, like, clumsy and just incredible.
For, you know, whatever metaphorical value They Live has, it is very blunt, I suppose, in what it's trying to say.
Right.
In the messaging. But it's just, it's absolutely fascinating. And it's also, I think, the closest of the films that we've talked about to the actual you know, cockamamie conspiracy theory that is out there of, you know, the lizard people and Bohemian Grove and all of the QAnon stuff and
right.
the pyramid lizards that are running the world, you know, and setting oil prices and whatnot.
A movie like They Live is interesting because, you know, I listen to a podcast quite a bit that covers Alex Jones's show, and even he's a big fan of They Live. So, like, that movie has a lot of cachet with a lot of different people, some of whom I don't think fully understand or don't want to understand the satire involved.
Mm-hmm.
But that one definitely has had legs to it in terms of being a foundational conspiracy theory kind of movie. Are there that many directors and that many different genres that have as varied a filmography as John Carpenter has? Because it's all over the place in a good way, but it's like... The fact that he did They Live, but then also, you know, Halloween or Big Trouble in Little China or Escape from New York, those are all very different movies.
They gave him chances, and probably because he didn't waste a lot of money,
mm-hmm.
he was given more chances. It's when they start getting Michael Bay-ish
right.
where you start thinking, we've got to come through with a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you're saying, that he got that so many of his films can be filed under a lot of different genres, but I think they all, you know, fit under the broad idea of genre. I mean, they're all, you know, movies that would be on a, like a drive-in screen in, you know, the early 80s. There's a certain, you know, grindhouse aspect to just about everything he did to whatever degree. But yes, I totally agree. I mean, yeah, he's definitely, the fact that he can do sci-fi and he can do, you know, actual hard horror and, you know, these, you know, crazy, whatever the hell you want to say Big Trouble in Little China is.
Yeah.
Just this kind of demented. I mean, how would you describe Big Trouble in Little China? Like it's a, like what, in Indiana Jones, like made out of bubble gum? Like, I don't even know.
Yeah, there's not really a good way. It's indescribable. Well, my last one, Bruce picked the conversation, which in part was kind of inspired by the Antonioni movie Blow Up, and I didn't pick Blow Up, but I did pick the kind of redone version of Blow Up that came out in the 80s here in the U.S., and that's Brian De Palma's Blowout, which is about a sound effects guy played by John Travolta who basically accidentally gets audio evidence of a assassination of a presidential candidate. And then just how everything spirals out of control from that. I kind of liked it because it's Blowout's definitely tapping into, like, you know, the JFK and RFK assassinations and other political assassination stuff. A lot like some of those 70s movies, which I was tempted to have a 70s movie or two on the list, but I didn't. But it has some of that, like, you know, like political candidate assassination stuff. But then it also has some of the other just weird cultural conspiracy theory stuff in it. Because I kind of think of the sound effect in that movie and him capturing the assassination, sort of like the urban legend always about that band, the Ohio Players, having the actual recording of someone like screaming as they're dying in one of their songs, which isn't true at all.
Roller Coaster.
Yeah, Roller Coaster, yeah.
Say what?
Yeah, like, it reminds me of something like that, or even like it reminds me of something like that, or even like the, you know, the Wizard of Oz thing with like the Munchkins supposedly hanging themselves off in the background. The kernel of how the plot springs from this movie is something that you kind of hear in other forms and like styles, like otherwhere and in other places in like culture with conspiracy theories. I love it quite a bit. I think it's one of Travolta's best movies, and it's maybe my favorite John Lithgow performance because he's in the supporting cast as like the I guess the fixer to kind of tie up loose ends once they realize that John Travolta has this audio, and he is as terrifying in Blowout as he's been in any movie he's ever been in.
The way that he like starts the whole scenario. So like Nancy Allen plays the woman who ends up kind of being like John Travolta's love interest, who was in the car that gets the tire blown out and whatnot. And John Lithgow, knowing that he's going to end up probably killing her, starts killing these other women who look like her just to establish this cover of of a serial killer killing people so that when she is killed, there won't be any, you know, anything that like directly connects her to that. Like it won't be she died because she was connected to that. She'll be dying because the serial killer got her. And it's just like the most insane, convoluted thing where he's just like, oh, also I get to kill all these people on the side. He's cold blooded in this movie. So good.
And what's weird is like it kind of feels like what he ended up doing later as the Trinity Killer in the fourth season of Dexter. But like to me, this one's even more terrifying because at least in like, you know, in Dexter, it's a serial killer who just has it as like a pathology. Like him in this movie, it's just a job to him, and that's what makes his character in Blowout even more terrifying.
Yeah.
And like kind of taps into this idea in a lot of conspiracy theories of just like these like, you know, guys that are putting hits out on people or whatever else. Mm-hmm. And like it's just this cold dead job to John Lithgow in Blowout.
Yep.
Brian De Palma is one who needs to be on any list. I like him. I like his work.
Yeah.
He's another one who has done so many different genres, you know, between Blowout, which is that, you know, conspiracy type thing. Dressed to Kill, Phantom of the Paradise, which is absolutely bonkers, to things like The Untouchables and Mission Impossible, which are, you know, like pretty solid, you know, just popcorn rewatchable, just really well done stuff. And he manages to do that while also squeezing in so many of his own personal, you know, strange, you know, fetishes.
Yeah.
What does it say about him casting his wife?
In so many things. Yeah. She was in Dressed to Kill as well.
Yeah.
And a couple of other of his films, I believe, too.
So was that just flipping business to the family, or was that this is how you see the character?
With Blowout specifically, I don't know. I mean, Jared might, you know, talk to this as well, but the way that her character is portrayed, if my husband was a director and he cast me as the character that Nancy Allen plays, this kind of like ditzy bimbo, you know, kind of prostitute because she's bored more or less, that would result in some pretty, pretty cold, you know, dinner conversation, I guess.
Or she runs around the house like that all the time, right?
The worst example of that has to be Christopher Nolan, because like the way women like are conveyed in his movies is not great. Like considering him and his wife work on those movies together, like how many dead wives there are in his movies, or like just bad relationships with wives there are in Nolan movies. Like he's probably an even bigger example of that than De Palma, although De Palma's a good one for it.
Okay, my last one. Are you ready for it? You're going to go, oh, come on. But it's All the President's Men. I have to have that on my list because that got you thinking about all these things. And for me, it was a real inspiration to get into journalism. I thought, wow, if you can ferret out these things and find this information and deal with it, what is the truth? You know, it was a fascinating film. When you watch it now, it is slow. But at the time, it was like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening.
It is slow, but it also feels appropriately slow. Not that you were saying that it wasn't, but I think people forget how long it took for this story to come out.
Well, and the ones we've seen recently, Spotlight or The Post, any of those kinds of things, they make it seem like everything is very quickly done. And our business is not like that. It is not. It often takes a long time to get a story that is of that magnitude.
To get a story of that magnitude, A, and then to endear enough sources to talk about something this big. Yeah. When I was putting together like an early version of my list and just kind of scooping everything together, Robert Redford is someone who ended up being in a whole bunch of these films.
Right. 3 Days of the Condor.
Yep.
Yeah.
Which was on my short list. It didn't end up rolling with it. But yeah, I mean, there's that even up till, Captain America, Winter Soldier.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, he all over the place in that kind of stuff. My number one pick is Sneakers.
Sneakers. Love it.
From 1992. It's a kind of a ragtag bunch of these oddball, you know, CIA former type people that basically get roped into this like NSA thing that can decrypt every website, where you plug it in and you make this thing happen, and all of a sudden you can access, you know, stoplights nationwide, or, you know, the nuclear arsenal. And then it's, you know, the NSA is trying to track them down. And yeah, the cast is absolutely incredible. It's got Robert Redford, Sidney Poitier, Dan Aykroyd is really great in that. River Phoenix in one of his final roles. And it's so sad watching him in things and being like, we really were robbed of someone who's going to grow into being a really great talent. And Ben Kingsley is the bad guy. Yeah, I'll stop just listing names, but it is really, really good. Another in that same, Man with One Red Shoe level movie that, is made for adults, starring adults, probably didn't cost a whole lot to make, and it's just a really great story. It's a movie that more people need to see. I feel like it got kind of missed way back when, and it hasn't really gotten the due it deserves.
So you had Sneakers and Man with One Red Shoe.
Yep.
Is there a theme there I need to look at?
Well, Hopscotch also is kind of a weird foot connection.
Yeah, there's a foot one there.
Yep. Tread.
Tread, that's a walking thing.
There we go, yeah. Sneakers was my last one, and it is great. Awesome. So yeah, so next time we'll be talking about animated films. Well, that was the show. You can check the show notes, like I said, for links to where you can stream the movies that we talked about and check out our archives. And hey, while you're making with clicking, you can subscribe to the show on Apple and Spotify and Stitcher and, wherever else you listen to podcasts if you haven't done that already. If you disagree with our picks, the review section in your pod player of choice is the appropriate place to put all that grumpiness. The show is produced by myself, Bruce, and Jared, and I'm the one who records and edits it. As always, thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show and are taking good care of yourselves out there. Till next time, bye.